Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Wormtown Studios. How are you, Lance?
Doing very well today. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's comfortable here in this studio, but in this interview coming up, Lance, we weren't in this black box.
We tried. We always like being nestled here in the Crawl Space studio in our black box, the safety confines of the
three and a half walls.
Mm. And we planned on having Chloe and Lou in, and there's some raucous behavior that goes on upstairs, especially on a Sunday, where it shakes the ceiling and deposits little bits of dust particles all over the place. So once a week, we get a clean up in here, and we had to take this one. As you said, we had to call an audible, and we had to take this one down the street. Wormtown coming through for us once again.
And so what we have is a really interesting and in-depth conversation with Lou Barry, who is a private investigator, former law enforcement. He was a police chief.
Guy is pure law enforcement. I don't think he's ever had a job in his life that didn't have anything to do with law enforcement. Even in his years now, he's still contracted as a licensed private investigator, and he's been working with Greg Overacker and with Bruce Maitland and others on Brianna's disappearance.
Yeah, he's great, and he really is doing some fine work right now on Brianna Maitland's case behind the scenes. A lot of things that he can't talk about. So this is actually great that we have him on for the first time, because we've been talking to him. We've been friendly with him for well over a year at this point.
This is really one of the perks of what we do. If you're into true crime and you're looking at cases and you are using your computer as your vehicle to find out facts, when you talk to someone like Lou, and you hear the facts that aren't out in the public, and you see the inner workings of an investigation, that is really one of the true perks. And we're really honored and humbled to be in the presence of somebody who will say, oh, this thing's been looked at, and we're currently looking at this. And we look at each other and we say, how can we possibly be involved with this and not know that? And it's because of the way law enforcement works. They just don't distribute information willy-nilly.
Right. And there's also a lot of like rumors and theories out there in Brianna Maitland's case, if you look online. So this episode, this conversation with Lou, is really kind of designed to clear some of that up, some of that conjecture out there. We have a whole segment where we're just trying to clear up what is a fact and what isn't a fact, what's speculation. So it's a great conversation and an important one if you follow the Brianna Maitland case.
I would even go so far to say it's a great one if you follow any of the missing person cases, because you can see how, even though there is rumor and speculation, someone like Lou does listen to that so that he has more information, and it's not a waste of time for him. He does go through it, and sometimes there is something there.
Okay, so we hope you enjoy this episode with Lou, and Chloe joins us as well. Thank you to both of them for making the trip out. So follow us on Twitter at CrawlSpacePod. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at CrawlSpacePodcast. Thank you very much. Welcome to the backup Crawl Space Studios here in Wormtown in Parts Unknown. I'm Tim, here today with Lance and Chloe and a very special guest. How are you guys?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing very well. We're still nestled, though. I don't want to make anyone think that we're uncomfortable here. our good friend and cameraman Joshua F. Leonard had a backup location for us
due to
unforeseen circumstances. Good to have you here, Chloe.
Thank you. I feel really nestled in here.
Yeah. Have to feel nestled.
Yeah.
And we have Lou Barry here, a very special guest who Lou is working on the Brianna Maitland case as a private investigator. And he is a former police chief and sort of all around great guy.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be here. Nestled as we are.
I just want to say real quick, we've been hearing everyone's comments about getting another Brianna episode out there, so we wanted to make sure that we came back with something strong, and this is about as strong as it gets at this point, having Lou with us.
Okay, so Lou, can we get a little bit of background on what you have done professionally in law enforcement?
Sure. I started off down on the Cape way back when, and worked with the Orleans Police Department for 10, 11 years, started as a patrolman and sergeant detective, was involved in quite a few cases down there, investigations and whatnot, and then came up to the western part of the state and as chief of police in the town of Granby for the next 24 years until I retired. I teach quite a bit at both colleges and at the police academies. And for the past few years, I've been doing private investigations also on the side.
You officially have a private investigator's license?
That's correct. Massachusetts.
Okay. Yeah. We just wanna, can I see it? Just kidding. Yeah. I'm totally kidding.
It's our new protocol.
You didn't vet him.
How did you get involved in Brianna's case?
Well, I went to college in Vermont and I have a lot of friends up there. So I just, now and then you see a story catches your eye and that Brianna's happened to way back when it happened. And then fast forward, after I retired, I started doing a different type of investigation relative to civil suits for victims, childhood victims of sexual assault who wanted to sue their assaulters due to a change in the statute of limitations. They can now do that up until the victim turns age 53. So I did a few cases like that, and basically had a little bit of downtime. I had a former partner who was involved heavily in a Molly Bish case, so I worked with her a little bit on that, and then we decided to look for another case to work on, and Brianna's kind of came to the forefront. So basically we met with Mr. Maitland, Bruce Maitland, and offered our services pro bono, and that's where it started.
And what year was this?
Let me see, that would have been in 2016 in the summer. That's when we first met Bruce. Yeah.
But you had known about Brianna's disappearance beforehand because of the work that you had done.
I was aware of it when it first happened back in 2004. Right. And then I kind of lost track of it, but had a few months prior to that started looking at it again. Yeah.
What was the first interaction like with Bruce?
He was cautious, I think understandably, not knowing who I was out of the blue that would contact him. And we met at a restaurant and felt very comfortable talking to him. He gave us some background information on it and kind of laid out what we were planning on doing. And basically, I think our relationship has developed there so that we're on very good terms with him.
What about the podcast so far? Our coverage of Brianna Maitland, we know there has been some inaccuracies at times, and we try to correct them and do better. But how has that gone, I guess, in your opinion? And is there any glaring inaccuracies that you want to address right up front?
I can't think of any off the top of my head that haven't already been addressed. There has been some, obviously, and I think you're well aware of that, and there's no point in rehashing or perpetuating things. But I think they're great in the sense that they get awareness out there. And cases are solved two ways, by forensic evidence or by information. And obviously, in this case here, there probably will be no forensic evidence. But so information is going to solve the case. And information comes from people. And the more people that are aware, then the better chance are of solving the case.
So the information that's being put out there, the communication and just the dialogue that's going out there by way of the podcast, is better than having nothing out there, even though you might get some false leads, you might get some people who come forward who just want the attention. All that is sort of maybe collateral damage, for lack of a better term. I suppose, like, what I'm saying is it better to get too much information as opposed to having to, like, really work for the information?
I don't think you never have too much information. It's frustrating sometimes because you're chasing ghosts. You're chasing stories that have been rehashed and changed, and they morph into a different story, and someone speculates on something, and the next thing you know, it's fact. And that's probably one of the most difficult parts of a cold case, is sifting through, what is accurate and what's exaggeration and what's speculation and conjecture. But again, we have fresh information coming in all the time, and it's because of the podcasts. It's because of the websites.
That's great. And you work with Vermont State Police on this?
I've met with them a few times. I have a very good contact up there, like the case officer, sergeant, I'm in contact with. Obviously, it's a one-way street. Police agencies don't share for obvious reasons. So I try to help them with what I've learned. And as I said, but we keep in touch, yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And you and Chloe have a relationship outside of the podcast, right? You've accompanied Lou on some... Well, go ahead and...
Sure. Yeah. Last year, Lou and I went up to Burlington, Vermont to interview some people. He was nice enough to invite me to come along. And that was really my first exposure to interviewing relevant parties in this case, or parties that could be relevant. And it was like probably one of the best weekends ever. So cool.
What about it made it so cool?
I've been so fascinated with this case and so emotionally invested, I guess, and hopefully... having justice found for Breonna and her family one day. So actually, I wasn't taking a dominant role in the interviews at all. I was really kind of observing and letting Lou do what he's professionally done for years. But actually seeing that kind of detective work right before my eyes, and there was one time where Greg Overacker met with us, and I got to really observe them interview someone at the same time. It's just really cool. You can't replace that by watching a documentary or a movie.
Chloe was a great help, because I don't prefer not to interview females alone, for obvious reasons. So I asked her if she'd come up there with me, and she readily agreed. And we met Greg up there, and the three of us conducted one or two interviews. And then she and I did another one. I think her eyes were opened a little bit to a different type of lifestyle on a second one. But the it went well, and it was great to have her, not only to be there, but offering kind of a different viewpoint, a different perspective than mine. You know, she's got a good background in psychology and has dealt with some difficult issues and everything. So it was really very, very, very helpful to me.
And this was all in relation to Breonna's case.
Yeah. I think there were three people we spoke to, and all of them, one way or the other, either came forward with leads, either directly to Lou or in the past, or had been associated with people that we were interested in.
That must have been a hell of a dynamic, going in there with yourself, Greg Overacker, and Chloe. And I'm picturing, like, good cop, bad cop, and...
I'd sing like a canary.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's like, if this guy's not going to be nice to me and I'll give the answers, this guy's going to be mean to me, or this young lady is going to psychoanalyze me until I'm on the floor crying. So it's just, it's a win-win-win for you guys.
She actually came with me a second time out to Great Barrington, where we interviewed and met a woman who had some close ties to the case. And again, I think Greg met us out there too, didn't he?
He did.
And the three of us interviewed her as well. So she's been a big help. And a lot of times I'll bounce things off of her. You know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? Particularly as it comes to the psychological aspect of things. So.
And that really comes into play a lot.
Yeah, that's
it really
great.
Does.
What is your relationship with Greg Overacker, other private investigator who's working on this case?
I met Greg, obviously, through Bruce, and he told me that, you know, Greg had been on the case for a number of years now. So I contacted Greg, and it was like, sure, yeah, he was glad for the help, and he sent me, a case of files. And I had an intern at the time through one of the classes I teach who came to the house and spent probably 6 hours scanning documents into the computer so we could return them to Greg. But you know, Greg was great. He shared everything he had, and we work together closely now. He's glad to have the help. I'm glad to have his knowledge and expertise. You know, we're both 4 hours away in different directions, but we have managed to meet up in Vermont. And every time he comes through on his way to Boston, we'll communicate. So it's great working with him. I talked to him on the phone last night for about an hour. We probably talk twice a week sometimes.
Great.
About the case and keep each other posted. And, you know, we work our separate angles, but we coordinate things and then share information, and, you know, works out pretty well.
I think that this case is really lucky to have both of you, honestly. Just, I'm sure that you, Tim, and Lance have seen that not everyone gets along in other cases, and having...
What? What are you talking about?
I don't know. I probably just saw that in a dream, but I think Greg and Lou don't have a problem with ego. They collaborate together, and I feel like every case should have that.
When you said that you two with Greg went to, oh no, this was a separate visit with just you and Chloe, and you said that Chloe saw a side of life that she probably wasn't that familiar with. What was that?
A witness we were, our potential witness, I guess, who we're interviewing, that was telling us about how she made her income doing live online video broadcasts from her bedroom.
It's kind of like what we do with podcasting, right?
Yeah, she's a YouTuber.
Yeah, kind of the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
probably has a Patreon.
I don't think that's what Lou was getting at.
I think it was a little bit more on the down low than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. You could forward, just for research purposes, could you forward the hyperlink to us?
Oh, and gosh.
Just so we can, you know.
So let's get into fact versus speculation here. Based on some case news, some case information, I think this is really something good to run by you if that's cool with you.
I think people that are in the Facebook groups have seen that. I think you're pretty good at catching a speculative thought as it progresses. And I mean, it's not like you're commenting on everything, but I will see that if sometimes people can get really off track based on things that they've heard, and you're really great at explaining, here's what's speculation, here's what's not. So why not do it here?
Okay, so the first one here we have, Brianna Maitland was told don't go to work when shopping with her mother the day she went missing. Is that true or is that speculation?
That's total speculation. There's never, that I'm aware of, been any confirmation that she talked to anyone. I know the story goes they were shopping and she all of a sudden had to leave, and then afterwards she was agitated, but... And someone speculated, well, she saw someone and they warned her. And then there's another story about exactly who warned her. And that now has turned into fact for some people that this individual warned her. And the fact of the matter is that can be explained by other reasons also. As far as Brianna goes, she smoked cigarettes at the time. She didn't smoke in front of her mother. She had taken the GED exam, got picked up by her mom. They went shopping. She was probably dying to have a cigarette. That's what her dad says anyways. And as far as being agitated goes, well, she had to go to work. It was running late. She had to be to work at the Lantern. She had to go home. She had to change. She had a 20-mile ride to the Lantern. So that could have explained her agitation just as easily as anything else. I mean, I've been to the shopping plaza there. And it was in St. Albans, which is nowhere connected to any of these people involved in this whole thing. So the chances of one of them being in this parking lot in St. Albans and her happening to see them just seems kind of far-fetched.
Right. So it would have had to have been someone who knew about this plan later that night who happened to randomly see Bree and her mom, or somehow followed them from where she took the GED, which is even more unlikely.
Yeah, and then a friend... This friend that supposedly warned her was later involved. I mean, it just doesn't add up at all. So I don't put any fact in that at all. I don't put any truth to that.
And that whole story came from one person in particular, right? It wasn't anything that was ever reported by law enforcement, by the family. It was just based on one person's account.
Correct.
So that wasn't reported by her mother.
Well, her mother said that she left and that she was agitated.
Yep.
When she came back, she was agitated.
Well, when she met her outside, I think they got in a car and she seemed agitated. But again, I've told that wasn't uncommon for Brianna to be agitated with her under circumstances like that.
Yeah,
like
raise your hand if you were mean to your mom when you were 17 as a girl.
Yeah, exactly.
My hands up.
You know, her mom was shopping. She wanted to go to work. you know, so.
Mm-hmm. What about the stories of Brianna owing people money?
I've heard that from some reliable sources that she may have, but how much and to whom is all speculation. And there's no indication that a 17-year-old girl would owe enough money that would result in someone causing her harm. I mean, if someone owes you money and you collect, you're not going to collect it if you do something to them. So the only way that I could possibly see that come into play is if, you know, perhaps there was some idea of trafficking her or something along those lines. And again, that's pure speculation. I don't want to, you know, say that's a fact or anything else because it's just speculation.
And it's not unheard of for someone to resort to violence in response to a debt. But like you said, it's not the most practical way to go about it because you're not going to collect that money.
Well, the only time you would do that is if you wanted to send a message to other people. And if that's the case, then it's a public thing. You leave the body where people are going to know what happened. That's how you scare people.
It's a statement.
To make a statement, correct. Yeah, and that's not the case here. And I can't see her owing enough money that anyone would go to that extreme to collect. You know?
How about this one? True or false, DNA was recovered at the crime scene that law enforcement believe belongs to a perpetrator in the case?
I believe there was DNA recovered. As far as who it belongs to, again, it's speculation. She was living out of her car, basically, for a while. And so she had people in her car doing, you know, whatever. And I know there was vomit in the car, but that's been explained as being belonging to an ex-boyfriend from some time earlier. So if there was DNA taken, it's great. However, even if they identify who it belongs to, it doesn't necessarily mean it was anywhere tied into her disappearance. In fact, by the looks of the scene, probably not, because I don't think anything happened in the car. So the presence of DNA in a vehicle, to me, would be kind of pointless, meaningless. You know?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm glad you brought up the vomit, because that's something that's pretty widely reported, that Brianna vomited that night. She vomited in her car or during the course of her abduction. Some people have even gone as far as to say that there's evidence that she was injected with a hot shot, which either caused her to vomit or rendered her unconscious and more easily abductable.
Speculation again. It's just...
Wouldn't you think that it would be stranger if there was no DNA in the car after seeing the car and realizing that she lived out of the car?
Well, you know, I think there's DNA in everybody's car. I mean, you get in a vehicle, there's hair, there's skin fault. Yeah, absolutely. How valuable the DNA, you know, I mean, the DNA is valuable if it's at the crime scene and you're trying to identify who's at the crime scene, or if it's on the body and it belongs to someone else. Well, we don't have a body, and realistically, the crime scene was contaminated immediately, almost, or soon thereafter. So DNA in this case, short of finding maybe, you know, her clothing somewhere and having DNA on it, I don't see where DNA is going to be a big factor in this case at all.
I even think that was reported in the mainstream media that, like, the, you know, new DNA evidence has been uncovered. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, perfect. They're going to solve this. But I don't know why they'd come out and say that.
Maybe just trying to shake things up a little bit.
I don't know. It feels like you said, unless there's DNA on an article of clothing that would just clearly suggest something bad happened, it's just, what could you do with any DNA you find in there anyway?
Yeah, it's a problem. There's probably a bunch of people's DNA in the car, skin, as we talked about, hairs. There's no way to prove that any DNA found in that car got there from the moment she was taken from the car.
Right. The only significance would be if they could identify it, it belonged to someone who was totally off the radar, never had any known connection to her, and, you know, developed as a viable new suspect, or perhaps someone who had a prior record for that, or somebody like Israel Keyes, who had been mentioned at one point, or something along those lines. But, and that, so that's just very, very unlikely, I think, in this particular case.
Right, because if it's someone like Keyes, then that guy's a professional serial killer. He's not leaving the scene looking like that, and he's certainly not leaving DNA. So right. So
well, yeah, probably.
Probably not.
Not where they appears that they've found the DNA. There's a picture somewhere where they've taken swats of the car, you know, cut it out, which I assume is where the DNA was. And I think it was mostly in the back seat. So the fact that anything happened in the back seat that day is pretty unlikely to me.
Speaking of Israel Keyes, true or false, Israel Keyes is ruled out of Breonna's disappearance.
He was ruled out, and I don't know by whom or how or why, but I've read anyways that he has totally off the map as a suspect.
Yeah, I think I read that too. Maybe the FBI had ruled him out?
I believe it was the FBI, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
True or false, Breonna's ex-boyfriend drove past Breonna's abandoned car at 4 a.m. on his way home from Canada.
Partially true. He saw the car. He stopped the vehicle. It wasn't at 4. It was earlier than that.
He stopped his vehicle.
Yeah.
Okay.
And apparently shut the lights off, shut the door, and then continued home. The reason that initial story came out is he was involved in some activity that he didn't want everyone to, the police particularly, to be aware of. And so he basically gave them the wrong time. He was not in Canada, which I should have been easy enough to check because they keep track of who comes across the border. If, in fact, the border was open then, I don't know what the status of the crossing was back then, whether they manned it 24/7 or not. But if they had, then they would have record of him coming back and what time it was and everything. But as far as he told me, he was not in Canada.
So is that something that the current law enforcement proved wrong, like looked into, told him, look, you weren't there, and give us another example, or he told you separately?
I don't know what he's told law enforcement. I know he's told them different things at different times. They're aware of what he told me, and I believe he's been cleared as a suspect.
But he did contaminate the crime scene unknowingly by being there. He shut the door, so the door was open and the lights were on.
That's what he told us, yeah. He shut the doors, shut the lights off.
And what time was that if it wasn't?
About 2:30.
2:30. So that takes like an hour and a half away from a potential time frame that anything could have happened. If he said that he was originally there at 4 and she wasn't there. So now you back that up to 2:30.
2:30, yeah. But, I mean, the car had come by at like 12:30 and she wasn't there. So we know it was a fairly tight timeline anyways.
So this person's been cleared, but for the listener out there, they're probably thinking, this guy changed his story. It's suspicious that he drove by the car and he touched it. It's the fact that he's an ex-boyfriend at all should make him a suspect. What do you have to say to that?
Well, as far as him seeing a car, it's the road he was on would have been on going back to where he lived. So it's right on the road. The Dutchburn house was virtually on the road. He recognized the car. He stopped. If he was involved, why would he have even interjected himself in the first place and admitted he saw the car? It doesn't make any sense. You don't know anything.
There's at least an anecdote that people will use. Oh, you know, it's not uncommon for killers to inject themselves into the case. So I think that's maybe where some people would be coming from. I don't agree with it, but.
Yeah, I suppose if you look at people like Bundy, maybe.
Right.
But. This guy's no Bundy. I mean, I don't believe that to be the case this time anyway.
How much do you know about him? Did he have a criminal record beforehand? Was he in trouble a lot? And has he gotten into trouble since?
Nothing major that I'm aware of.
My understanding is just maybe like driving offenses.
Are there any persons of interest, at least by the public standards, that you believe should be disregarded at this time?
I wouldn't rule anybody out. I think some are more likely to be involved than others. It's usually a mistake to rule anyone out 100%. I think some of the stories that are going around could be ruled out. They just don't make any sense. You know, one of the things that Chloe and I were discussing on the way down here is very few people knew that she worked at the Lantern. She hadn't been there that long. And no one knew, including her, what time she was getting out of work, because there's a window of a couple of hours with the dishwashers before they would leave. So for someone to say, okay, she's going to be by here at 11:30, ain't going to happen. You'd have to be sitting there for potentially 10 o'clock till midnight were the time frame. Even the note said that that she left for her roommate. She'd be home. She was getting out sometime between 10 and 12, and she'd be home. So she didn't know. I've talked to the former owner of the place. He said, that's right, the dishwashers, depending on how busy it was a, you never know how long they were going to be there. That kind of leads me to believe that no one was necessarily sitting by the Dutch Burn house waiting for her to drive by. I don't, at least some of the suspects, I don't think would have the patience to do that.
To wait and attack her there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're talking now maybe more of an opportunistic thing, which kind of leads away from that circle that has always been the main suspects.
I mean, what if it was something where someone was waiting for her to leave her job and then they contacted the people and said, she's leaving, she should be going by the Dutch Burn house, you know, in 20 minutes?
For one thing, there's no cell service up there. So contact how? And now you're talking more people being involved in tight groups or not. You get more than two people, one person involved in something, and eventually the truth comes out. That's been my experience anyways.
Yeah, I think a lot of people's theories are rooted in that, you know, they knew that she was getting off work and they were waiting to ambush her. But the important point of emphasis is no one, not even Brianna, knew when she was getting off work. So that, I feel like, rules out a lot of theories that have been circulated.
And even fewer people, well, not fewer people, but few people knew that she even worked there. Because she'd only been working there a few weeks. This is only her... I think her second weekend.
This is a great clue. Who knew? Do we know who knew that she worked there?
No, for sure. I know a couple people that definitely were not involved. Obviously, her family, for one.
Yeah, her roommate.
As far as other people, I know a number of them said they did not know she was working there, which would be consistent with the fact that she was on the outs with that group due to the fight a couple weeks earlier. As far as who actually knew... you know, I think you could probably number of people on count on one hand.
Her ex-boyfriend at the time?
Most likely. Yeah. Maybe a few others, you know.
Nathaniel Jackson?
Probably, yeah.
Wow. So, okay, so if the person didn't know that when she was going to get out and there was no staged, you know, attack waiting for her as she drove past the Dutch Burn... why did her car and how did her car, I mean, you know, obviously speculation, but you know, did she stop there and have a drink or something? Was there someone that she met with? I mean, why, how, and how, if you're just driving alone and along past that road, how does your car end up like that?
It's hard to say, obviously, again, it's all speculation, but her car had actually, according to her dad, who saw the scene shortly thereafter, within a week anyways, her tire marks, you could see, started about 100 feet past the house in the field, backing up in a slight arc.
It started on the street and went into the field.
Well, you could see it on the grass. So, yeah, obviously it must have started on the street.
Okay.
But she had passed the Dutch Burn house, in other words. And then apparently the car was put in reverse and was backed up. There's a slight curve right where that happens. If you turn your wheels to make a curve and you stop and then you throw it in reverse, you're going to go the opposite way. And that's exactly what looks like happened. Now, that's, again, speculation. My guess is somehow she was forced to stop either another vehicle, recognized that there was an issue, threw it in reverse, backed up, hit the gas, and hit the house. The car was hung up on the house. In fact, the first time I went up there, you could still see the scrape mark on the foundation of the place before it was demolished.
Hung up in a sense where she couldn't, if she put it in drive, she couldn't drive away.
Her right rear wheel would have been off the ground. Yeah, very likely, yeah. You know, without having a vehicle there measuring it, but she was definitely, that bumper was up on the foundation. Top of the foundation.
So she was driving past and ended up changing plans in a real hurry and sort of in a panic, it seems like, and seems like slammed on her gas and threw it in reverse and hit the house. So now the question is, what did she see to make her panic and slam on the gas in reverse?
Right. It's anybody's guess.
Something that scared her, though.
Something that, yeah.
Scared her enough to put the car in reverse, because I was thinking, well, maybe she just forgot something at the Black Lantern. Maybe she forgot something and she was going to turn around, but you don't back up like that and whip it around. You would just do like a 3-point turn.
And it seemed like an escape rather than, oh, something's in the road, I need to stop or I need to help someone. It like sounds like she was really trying to get away. Maybe that's speculation.
Turn around, yeah, go the other way.
I mean, she could have stopped. Brianna was, from what everyone says, a very helpful person, and she one time brought home a hitchhiker to her house. She felt sorry for him, so she brought him home to have a nice meal. So that's the type of trusting person she was. So, you know, someone maybe with the hood up waves her down, she stops, and then all of a sudden realizes this isn't a good thing.
Wow.
I don't know. But that, again, speculation. I don't want to put any fact to that because that's just theory, that's all.
Were there any other tire marks in the grass that didn't match up with her car?
Well, there had been so many vehicles there, you know, once they found out what was going on. First, you had this, the traveler stopped, took pictures. State trooper was there. The tow truck operator came. And then by the time when they realized that that was the crime scene, of course, they had, I saw one picture. There must have been 8 state police cars there and all sorts of vehicles. So, you know, the scene was relatively contaminated relatively soon.
I have one more question about the crimes. I guess you could, it is a crime scene.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Okay. That stretch of road, is it windy? Is it narrow? Is it straight? It's a major route?
It's a major route to Montgomery, if there is such a thing. I wouldn't say it's a major route, but it's well-traveled during the daytime. I mean, on the other hand, I sat there probably one day for about 20 minutes and maybe 2 cars went by. So, you know, it's not like Route 91.
Right.
But it's still the road you get from Montgomery if you're going to Swanton or anywhere west. That's the road you go on. The house is right on a road, literally feet from the road. So anything going on would be readily visible to anybody going by. I don't know in March at 11:30 at night that you'd say traffic was probably pretty light. That's why the theory of a serial killer just happening to be there and is kind of far-fetched. I mean, if you're a serial killer, you don't stand on route and whatever road number it is on Montgomery at 11:30 at night waiting for your victim. You could be there for a month.
Pretty straight run?
Yeah, slight curve.
Okay.
Nothing major, but there is a curve there. In fact, when I first started getting interested in the case, I'm sure you're familiar with the story of the two brothers that lived there, the Dutchburn brothers. It's mentioned in the story how cars in the wintertime would not negotiate the curve and go off into the field, and they'd come bang on the door and they'd go and pull them out of the mud or whatever in the snow with their tractor. So, you know, that indicates to me that it was maybe more of a curve than you don't think about how bad they are when you're driving them sometimes.
But there was no snow up there at the time in March?
There was snow in the field, but it wasn't deep.
Okay.
Because the area right around the house looked like bare grass, but you can see in the pictures further out into the field that there's some type of snow cover.
Speaking of that area and the Dutchburn house, do you want to tell us a little bit about what the Dutchburn house meant to the community at the time of Brianna's abduction? Was it a place where people met up? Was it a place that had any evidence at all?
When I first heard, you know, farmhouse and an abandoned farmhouse and everything, my first thought was it was a place where the kids maybe went to party or something. Initially, when we started talking to our friends, we asked them that, and they were like, no, it's just a place. We had plenty of places to party that were out, you know, gravel pits and in other places that, you know, had a lot more privacy than that. That was right on the road. It wasn't a significant place. I've heard it referred to as the crack house. It wasn't a crack house. It was an old farmhouse that was boarded up that sat right on the road. So there was no, you know, activity there. Everybody knew it as the Dutchburn place, and it was kind of had this ominous feel to it, I think, if you knew the history of it. But it wasn't certainly a place where kids would go to party because it was too obvious. Anybody coming by would see them there.
Right. Cops could break it up right away.
Yeah, immediately.
And as you mentioned, the dark past that the location has, weren't the brothers were killed there, right?
They weren't killed. They were severely beaten.
Ah, that's right.
I'm not sure they ever returned to the place after that, but they were beaten up pretty badly.
Was it a home invasion?
Yes. They had the brothers had a habit of carrying a lot of cash on them. And someone knew that apparently, and that's what happened.
The perpetrators are actually caught because the brothers were farmers and spent so much time in a barn that the perpetrator tried to use the money or tried to spend the money that was stolen, and it smelled so strongly of barn that they knew it belonged to the Dutchburn brothers.
No way.
So I wasn't aware of that.
I read that in the New York Times article, and that article actually ended with they stopped answering the door to help people that failed to navigate that curve after that incident because they were really traumatized and they ended up going to assisted living. But the article ended with a young driver had spun off that curve and knocked on their door and they just ignored him until he left.
What has the investigation revealed about the likely profile, like behavior and traits of the perpetrator or perpetrators?
I'm not sure anything. I mean, I don't think, you know, that you can really draw any conclusions from this because there's just so many possibilities there. You know, she was leading an at-risk lifestyle at the time, exposed to some people that were not very nice. So certainly there's, you can look in that direction. You look in the direction of someone that just, you know, someone that we were not aware of, somebody totally off the radar, right? So I don't know, because there's no evidence at the scene and there's no body, so you've got no method of death, if there is a death, no evidence like that. I don't think you can draw any conclusions at this point. There's just nothing there to draw them from, you know. I mean, just usually there's two places you're going to get evidence, and that's at the scene and at the body. And we don't have a body, and as I said before, we assume that's where she was killed, but not necessarily. She might have just abducted from there. In fact, she probably wasn't killed there. She probably just abducted there, so... There's just no evidence.
So you're fairly confident that this was a murder?
At this point, yeah.
Okay.
I think any chance of her being alive, unfortunately, is long, long past. I even if she had been trafficked, I think she would have, in 14 years, been able to come forward. And I can't see her not contacting family and friends. I mean, she just wasn't that type of kid, you know.
Does this remind you of other investigations that you've worked on?
Not really, because usually you have a body. I mean, you know, I was involved in another homicide in our town years and years and years ago where we made an arrest before we found the body. But that was, you know, pretty unusual as a result of the publicity of making the arrest without the body. We found the body. It was in a storage facility. So, you know, you don't, to have a case like this where absolutely there's no crime scene, there's no body is pretty unusual, I think, you know. I mean, even in Maura Murray's case, they have a little bit more of a crime scene anyways than they do with in this case here, you know.
You just said in Maura's case they have a little bit more of a crime scene than in this case.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I would have thought you would have said the opposite. Just with the way the car was found buried into the house.
Nah, because it's just, you know, that's all you have is the car. You know, I mean, it's just, maybe had it been investigated immediately, it might have been a different situation, you know, as far as footprints, some type of evidence at the scene or anything. But, you know, they're both obviously very mysterious cases, if you will. That's probably why they haven't been solved.
Earlier, you said something about patience that would be required. Since Brianna didn't even know what time she was getting off that night, it could have been a chance encounter. It could have been someone waiting outside of her work to know when she was leaving. Do you think that rules out some people if it was indeed someone waiting?
I don't want to rule anything out completely. But I'm leaning now more towards a connection to the lantern than a connection to that other group, just because so few people did know that she was working at the lantern, that's all. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the other group wasn't involved, but I'm leaning now more towards a lantern connection.
So more towards somebody who either worked with her or somebody who frequented as a customer.
I doubt it was anyone who worked with her, but perhaps a customer or someone who lived in right near the area or something.
That would be, I don't know the layout of the Black Lantern, but wouldn't that be difficult as a customer to develop a fixation with the dishwasher? Because typically dishwashers don't come out onto the floor.
Did she bust tables though?
I don't know, but I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that a customer might have had contact with her.
It was reported that she would chat with people at the bar. I don't think she was just always hid away in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think we've all done restaurant jobs and dishwashing jobs, and you do go out and you collect, the bus tubs from the bar, or you go out to get like a drink or something, like a water or a Coke or something.
Yeah, I was a bar back for a year or two or something like that, and you definitely have conversations with people at the bar. Yeah,
yeah, especially if there's been in the bar. She's a young, good-looking girl, so. You know, would not be surprising at all.
Was a Black Lantern something that people who were in transit frequented a lot?
Ski season, I think.
Okay.
Yes. I don't think it was it wasn't a bar where people would go and say, oh, I'm, you know, going to meet people at the bar. But I think it had a clientele that was, you know, somewhat regular, and they'd stop in and have a drink or two. And it wasn't a huge bar, I guess. It was, for what the owner tells me, it was a really small, you know, service-type bar, but obviously they had drinks there, so.
Were, receipts and the patrons who were there that night investigated and everything?
As far as I know, the state police have checked all of that. But my guess is if it was someone involved, they weren't there that night. Because if they left right after her, someone would have noticed that.
Right, so, yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at.
Might have been a customer that was not there that night.
Right, a customer wouldn't even be there when she leaves, because she's leaving after everything's done, after everything's wrapped up. You know, they would have had that guy.
But not in this case, though.
No, I'm saying if he was in the restaurant waiting for her, they're not letting him stay there past closing.
She left before closing, though, didn't she?
I don't know what time they closed. I don't know. All I know is she was a dishwasher, and when the dishes were done, she was done. I know the other employees were there because they asked her to stay. Apparently, they would stay and eat and have a drink, and she told them no because she had a second job at a restaurant in St. Albans, breakfast restaurant. She had to be there for 7, and she didn't show, obviously, for the restaurant. The owner of that restaurant thought that she, irresponsible teenager, works one week and doesn't come the next, so they didn't really think much of it. The owner's wife saw her get into the car, saw her, because they had a separate living quarters, and she was standing in the doorway, and she watched her walk from Lantern to her car.
Yeah.
And get in. So,
okay.
I mean, the other theory that's been, I've heard, is that someone was hiding in the back seat of her car, but it doesn't make a lot of sense because, so we'll play that out. They hid in the back seat of the car, and they jumped up, and they surprised her at the Dutchburn house. How did they leave the scene, and how did they take her with them? Unless they had a car hidden there, but they, you know, that's kind of to hide the car and walk to the Lantern doesn't make, you know, not going to walk a mile. They don't. So again, there would have to be a second person involved in another car, and it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
Another piece of relevance with the Black Lantern Inn is that she had 2 paychecks on her passenger seat. A lot of people will say if she owed someone money, or if this was motivated by money at all, they would have taken the checks. True or false?
Yeah, that I've read that also, and that's totally false. Checks are easy to trace. If I forge a check and cash it, there's a record of that. There's maybe video of that. The bank teller sees me do it. So the last thing anyone would want to do is connect himself to a crime for a $30 paycheck. So it's, you know, totally irrelevant, I think, that the checks were there. Again, they didn't amount to much. In fact, they'd never been cashed. So that, I think, was her first pay because she'd only been there. They said they paid every 2 weeks, which would make sense. She'd been there 2 weeks. She got 2 paychecks when she went that night, and there they were in the car. So their presence, I think, is kind of just irrelevant. But it certainly doesn't play into the fact that she may or may not owe somebody money. Anybody with half a brain would know that the last thing you want to do is to connect yourself to the crime by forging a $30 check.
It was only $30?
Yeah, it wasn't much. I think the total was like $60 or something.
Oh, wow. Gotcha.
It was minimal amount.
Had you ever seen the vehicle? And where is the vehicle now?
It's junked, yeah. They held on to it for quite a while, and then it was just Bruce couldn't have it around anymore, so they got rid of it.
I think it was subject to a lot of gawkers. I think they had it parked in a way where people would come by and just check it out, and it's not good.
Plus, every time he saw it, it would bring back a memory. I mean, I can't even imagine what he went through when they realized the car had been, she was missing, and the car had been towed to Lutz's, and Waylon, his son, and he went with the bar to open that trunk to see if she was inside. I can't even imagine that seconds of not knowing and not knowing what you were going to see when you opened that trunk. So every time he saw that car, I'm sure it brought back memories.
That is a very like disturbing moment to even think about how much distress and desperation you must feel. And they moved urgently and quickly. They got that crowbar and they opened up that trunk, probably outraged that it hadn't been done yet.
Half hoping she was there and half hoping she wasn't there.
Right.
Right.
When was it officially declared a part of the crime scene? The car, I mean.
As I understand it, the timeline goes something like this. She got to work at 11:20. The trooper came by the next day, saw it, threw the necklace and maybe some change or some other small items back into the car, went to the Black Lantern to see if he could find out who she was or where it was. And they were closed, so he called Lutz's garage to tow it, and they towed it sometime after 9:30, they didn't have an exact record of when it was towed, but sometime after 9:30 in the morning, they went and towed it. And it sat in the garage. That was on Saturday morning. Jillian came home Sunday night. Brianna wasn't there, so she figured she was with her mother. Monday, she called her mother. Mother said she didn't know where they were, so they start calling friends of theirs. Tuesday, they got concerned. They called the state police, and I think on Thursday, they went to the barracks with her picture and a picture of the car. And then the trooper who had it towed saw the picture of the car, said, I towed that car last Saturday. So it was 7 days, almost a week.
So they knew it was Brianna, the state police. The trooper knew that she worked at the Black Lantern because he went there.
He did not know it was Brianna. He knew she worked at the Lantern.
Her name wasn't, I mean.
Oh, it must have been on the check. Yeah, he must have known. Yeah, the car was registered to Kelly, I think.
When the state trooper figured out that this was Brianna, how is it not followed up on more aggressively when he knows or probably knows that she's 17 years old? Why was there such a gap in time before figuring out how to contact the parents on this?
Well, they never did contact the parents. The parents brought the picture to them, basically.
So he never contacted
them. He went on days off, is the explanation I got.
Is that typical for a police officer to just say, you know, that's out of sight, out of mind for me?
It depends on the officer.
Yeah.
It depends on the agency, I guess. You know, I don't want to be critical because I wasn't there.
How big was the garage that they towed it to?
It's a one-man shop.
Was it
in Montgomery? But they had a little compound there. I mean, you could easily go by and not notice a car.
Okay.
It was in Montgomery Center as opposed to Montgomery, which is close by, but another little hamlet, I guess, a little village. She would have been going in the opposite direction of where the vehicle was towed to. So if they went looking for the vehicle, they wouldn't have seen it unless they went in the wrong direction than they would normally go.
Okay. Was this a place that the police towed vehicles to a lot?
Up there, it was the only game in town from what I've seen. I don't know, you know, how many tar cars they actually towed. You got to understand that law enforcement presence up there is minimal at best. There is no local police. State police, they had gotten away from having resident troopers in the towns. So they're at the mercy of the trooper that was on patrol in that particular area. And they cover a pretty big area. When they needed assistance, they'd call Border Patrol. That was the closest agency that had manpower on. So we're talking a rural, almost remote area with very little law enforcement presence.
It'd be interesting to talk to that trooper.
So what do you think should be the focus of the investigation at this point?
Well, I think any new leads that come in have to be followed up aggressively. Other than that, keep looking for new information. I mean, I think any information that we've had has been pretty well covered. I'd like to think that Greg and I have pretty much gone over everything as best we can. I mean, you never know. Recontacting people sometimes helps because people change their mind, change their stories. They find religion. They a lot of things can happen where persistence sometimes pays off. And that's the advantage, I think, of a private investigator over the police is that we have the time that they don't have because they have such a volume. And they have to react to this fresh stuff happening. And the more time goes by, the less time they have to devote to cases, the older they get. And as a private investigator, you work your own caseload. So,
in the pictures that the public has seen of Brianna's car, lights are off, doors are closed. For the people that saw her car soon after it was left there, what was the condition it was left in?
I think two people went by prior to 2:30, one of which put the time somewhere between, if I'm not mistaken, 11:30 and 12:30 or something along those lines, and said that the, I'm not sure about the doors, but the lights were on, or at least the hazard lights or blinker or some light was on. And then someone else went by around 1:30 and basically said the same thing, that the lights were on, or parking lights were on, or some type of lights, but they didn't pay much attention to it. Again, you got to understand up there, it's not uncommon for someone to have an accident and go home. Because if you wait for the police, you could be waiting on a long, long time because they don't come by that much. So it's not uncommon for someone who goes off the road, hits something, car disabled, to get another ride and go home and not even think to call the police and say, hey, this is what happened. You know, it's just a different way of life up there.
So lights were on, and then the boyfriend comes at 2:30, and you said he closed the door.
That's what he told us. Shut the door, shut the lights.
So were both doors open?
Both doors open.
So what does that say?
It could say she was trying to get out one side, the other person came in the other. Or it could say there's two people there. Could say anything, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. And the lights on, and there, you said there was a necklace. Was that confirmed to be hers?
Yes. And there was, so that would indicate to me there was some type of a struggle. But maybe not. Maybe she knocked it out. Right? If she got out of the car fast, maybe. But that indicates to me that there was some type of a struggle or something there at the scene.
And that was found on the driver's side by that door, or we're not sure?
I'm not sure. I know it wasn't specified as to where, but I want to say it was, but I'm just...
In the photographs taken by the World Travelers, you can see a water bottle on the ground next to the driver's side.
Okay.
Along with a bunch of other things, but that was the only thing that I could actually identify.
Okay. And so James, the ex-boyfriend, he shut both doors or just one of the doors?
I think he shut them both.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And what was the condition of the fuel in the car? How much fuel did it have? Do you know?
No clue.
The car wasn't running when James showed up to shut the lights off.
No. And as far as I know, they never found the keys. However, it's not uncommon for vehicles of that vintage to not need keys.
Oh, yeah.
The ignitions would get sloppy. It's sloppy, and you could just turn the key.
I remember seeing that as a kid in some of those old cars.
We had a cruiser like that. You didn't need a key for it. You just turn the whole ignition that would start.
But I assume that you would have like a keychain. There's nothing like that found.
No.
So it's been speculated and reported that, I believe even in a mainstream news article, that weapons and drug paraphernalia were found in the Dutchburn house following Brianna's disappearance. Is that true?
No. Dutchburn house, as far as I know, the only piece of plywood that was off the window was the one that she hit with the car. I think what has happened over the years is the Dutchburn house being referred to as the farmhouse, which it was, an old farmhouse. And people are getting it confused with the house on River Road that was raided after the tip, which was also a farmhouse. And in that farmhouse, they found a gun and they found drugs and Ramon Ryan's, and he was charged and all that. And I think what happens is people say farmhouse, and people that are not totally familiar with the case assume they're talking about the Dutchburn farmhouse, when in fact they're talking about the River Road farmhouse. So the Dutchburn house, there was nothing inside of any value whatsoever. But it, again, it's just being confused with the River Road house.
I'm confused. Wait, was it River Road?
Reservoir Road. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Reservoir Road.
I was making sure there wasn't another one.
No, my bad. It was Reservoir Road, right?
All right. And for people that don't know, that's the house that was occupied by Ramon Ryans, Nathaniel Jackson, Timothy Powell, and Stephanie Machia. And they were all arrested.
And Michelle Uchetta. And from time to time, other people.
And they were all arrested at that point.
No, I don't believe. Again, this is a little vague, and I haven't really gotten the real story. I don't think anyone was arrested when they raided it, but when they raided it, they made observations, and they based on that, they got a search warrant, and they came back, and that's when Ramon was charged. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, he wound up pleading guilty and getting 45 days credit for time served, because he had left the state. They had to go get him. They brought him back. He was waiting. He was incarcerated, and he wound up pleading guilty for credit for time served, which was 45 days, which he had already served. So basically, he walked out the door and he left. And people were like, well, why was that such a light sentence? Well, part of it, I think, was because there was some questions on the search. You know, you go back to the original tip. Is there enough cause there to search the house or not legally.
Because they were looking for Brianna,
right? They were looking for Brianna. Okay. And, you know, it was an anonymous tip. Anonymous tips are extremely hard in the courts to justify as being a lawful search without a warrant. On the other hand, obviously, when the young lady's life might be at stake, that's secondary thought. At that point, was to get in there and see if she's there. While they were there, they made the observations. Well, if it was ultimately ruled to be an unlawful search the first time, then those observations would have been negated in that second drug charge would have been tossed out. So my guess is, and this is pure speculation on my part, that they worked a deal where, you know, they got a guilty plea out of it, yet he had a minimal sentence out of it, rather than take the chance on both sides of going to trial.
Right. It's not like he likely gave information on Brianna's whereabouts or something like that. And got,
I don't know what the transaction involved.
Yeah. I think they call that, is it fruit from a poisonous tree?
Fruit from the poisonous tree, correct.
Where if they find something and it's based from an unlawful search, everything's thrown out. So I understand why maybe they were being...
A little cautious, because it certainly would have been subject of discussion or of a motion as to whether or not that original search for her was based on probable cause or not. When you're dealing with anonymous tips, it's very difficult.
It was received by Bruce Maitland. I remember he told us that when we first interviewed him.
Bruce received the tip and he called the police up and he said, pretty much, if you guys aren't going to go there look for her, I'm going to go there looking for her. So they grabbed whatever help they could and they went and hit the house.
They really couldn't have that.
No, that wouldn't have been pretty, probably.
When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.